Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news, focusing mainly on the tinderbox confrontation between Russia and Ukraine following Russia's military occupation of Crimea and its threat to move into Ukraine. We will also look into the chaotic situation in Ukraine, where the military has just been mobilized by an unelected government whose treasury is empty, having been looted by the previous regime. We will begin and go to Moscow and speak with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, an independent defense analyst who writes for Novaya Gazeta, the only newspaper in Russia not controlled by Putin, and discuss what Russia's military objectives might be with Russia and Ukraine on the brink of war. Then we'll examine the Obama administration's limited options short of cutting diplomatic and economic ties with Russia and returning to a Cold War standoff. Charles Kupchan, who was the director of European affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration, joins us to discuss what might have transpired in the 90-minute phone conversation between Putin and Obama and what leverage the U.S. and West has over Putin. Then finally, we will speak with a Ukrainian scholar who is a specialist on nationalism, revolutions, and empires. Alexander Motel joins us to look into what Kiev can do to reach out to the Russian-speaking East, who Putin is claiming need Russian protection from fascists and terrorists, now that Putin has been given a blank check by the Russian parliament to intervene militarily anywhere on Ukrainian territory. Joining us now is Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as a senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences and from 1994 to 2005 published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, The Moscow Times. And in 2006, after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Pavel Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. Felgenhauer's regular commentary on Russia appears in many other local and international publications, and he joins us from Moscow. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer.
Well, hello.
So what's the from Moscow, what is the latest reports that you're seeing in terms of military activity? It seems as though Crimea has largely been occupied by Russian forces, but the parliament has given Vladimir Putin a blank check, I think, has he not, on intervening anywhere else in Ukraine, particularly in the east. Is that likely to happen, do you think?
Well, it's possible, and it was announced here in Moscow that if there's going to be any kind of suppression of pro-Russian demonstrations, and there have been some violent Moscow-sponsored rioting in Kharkiv and in the west and in Donetsk, and Moscow has said that someone's going to try and control those riots, Russia will intervene militarily. So, yes, there have been threats of Russian incursions, not only in Crimea, but also in other eastern Ukrainian provinces.
But that logic of having to defend Russian minorities in former Soviet republics, that would apply all over, wouldn't it? Estonia, Latvia, everywhere, surely.
Well, logically speaking, yes, that would apply to any country where you have a Russian resident.
So is there any evidence that the Russian residents in Ukraine are being oppressed? I mean,
No, there's no evidence at all. But apparently that's not a problem for the Kremlin.
So
they just need a they want a pretext, and they have a pretext to invade Ukraine. The idea has been for some time that either we impose a pro-Moscow government in Kiev, or if there's an anti-Moscow government emerging in Kiev, then Ukraine will break up, or we'll break it up, and we will pick up at least half of the pieces, some provinces lying to the west would maybe go to Poland or somewhere, remain independent, but we would pick up the southern and eastern part in Crimea, of course. It seems that President Vladimir Putin was personally very seriously offended by the collapse and meltdown of the Yanukovych regime in Kiev. And now he is hitting back.
Well, but what he's doing, though, is a violation of the UN Charter and of international law, and it doesn't seem to be bothered by that. But if you take this to its logical conclusion, how can you annex he's already successfully annexed Crimea, arguably, and that may result in no bloodshed. But I would assume that an invasion of the eastern Ukraine would be, and given that the government in Kiev has just mobilized its military, aren't you heading for a bloody conflagration?
Well, it would seem so. But in Moscow, they believe that the Ukrainian military is weak and disorientated because of the regime meltdown. Then maybe more, even Putin and many believe that the coup that ousted Yanukovych was organized by a very small group of radicals, and that the majority of Ukrainians are just waiting for Russia to come and liberate them. That's how it's kind of seen, all this hullabaloo was organized by the United States, that they are behind it, and we're going to push back against the Americans and take what we believe is ours. That's what the government propaganda is selling the Russian people. Apparently, many in Russia take the bait.
Well, I think probably a substantial majority, right, would believe. I mean, isn't that what's been going on in terms of, it's almost like what they call a psyop, psychological warfare? The propaganda has been going on for some time, saying exactly what you said, that this is all being...
Well, yes, that's very rather effective.
Yeah.
We maybe hoped that the Ukrainians would behave rashly, like the hot-headed Georgians in August 2008, and actually go into some kind of action. So we would kind of pretend that it's them who put the situation into real shooting contest. The Ukrainians up to now have been sitting on their thumbs, and Russia is also right now, at least the Russian troops in Crimea, are restraining themselves and not using firepower. And the Ukrainians are not using, apparently believing that who goes first trigger happy is going to lose seriously in the eyes of international community. Well, which has up to now been the only glimmer of hope in this very bad situation, that no one has been killed and we're not in a real fighting, shooting war with Ukraine.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences and published a regular column on defense in the English language, the local daily, the Moscow Times. And after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Pavel Felgenhauer joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta and is a regular writes regular commentary on Russia and appears in many other local and international publications. And he joins us from Moscow. But how can you calibrate, though, a bloodless military intervention and that doesn't turn into and even if, as you say, the Russian military basically is not afraid or perhaps even has contempt for the Ukrainian military, that is not a very effective one. Isn't there a history of guerrilla warfare, though, in Ukraine? Wouldn't that military...
Well, this was not a decision made by the Russian military.
Uh-huh.
Decision was made by one person, Russian Tsar Vladimir Putin.
I see.
And the military were just given marching orders. Apparently, that's his belief, that this can be pulled off in 08, in August 08, with Georgia. It worked out. The West huffed and puffed and then decided that Georgia does not really matter that much, and that the hell with them. We should have good relations back with Russia. That's more important. There are many in the West, especially in Europe, I say in Germany, maybe in the Obama administration, who believe that it's important to have very good relations with Russia. And the Ukrainians, well, it's bad what's happening, but what can we do? Our options are limited. So that's what most likely Putin is hoping, that there's going to be a lot of hullabaloo, and then it's going to blow over, but we'll keep Crimea. Of course, keeping Crimea would be an additional drag on the Russian budget. It's not a very productive place. It's a tourist attraction, and occupied by Russian troops, it will hardly be a very much tourist attraction anymore. But, well, empire building is a task that's never easy.
Well, but how could he not intervene now in the East and just settle for Crimea if you have this alleged situation of needing to protect the Russian Eastern? It's not the minority, it's the majority, I take it. So, are you confident that it's just going to be Ukraine, just going to be Crimea and...
No, it's, as I say, it was said officially that we can move into other places.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Russia does not have enough troops to actually defeat Ukraine or occupy Ukraine, the entirety of the country. Right now we have, I don't know, about maybe 6,000 combat troops deployed in Crimea. Not much, really.
Right.
Oh, compared to the armies of Joseph Stalin, when Joseph Stalin was occupying the Baltic states and other former Russian holdings. And not much we can move into eastern Ukraine, especially since the time of year is very wrong. Spring is coming, and in the black soils, the Chernozem, when the snow thaws, you can't fight only on roads, because in Kharkiv and Poltava and Voronezh, that's ready, of course, on the Russian side, a tank plows itself up to the turret into that thick black soil, which is, of course, very fertile. And before it dries up somewhere in June, tank warfare in those plains of Ukraine is not possible. Well, the Germans knew that. They were fighting there for several years.
So, but where would the fault line be then if you could succeed in annexing the East without a major battle? You'd still have Russian soldiers.
Well, I mean, we have enough forces we can't have march into Kiev and restore Yanukovych, bringing him in our wagon train.
Right.
We can have enough expeditionary capable forces to maybe bite off some parts, Crimea and some parts of eastern Ukraine. That means the central Ukrainian government will survive. They'll most likely mobilize volunteers. Most likely there'll be hundreds of thousands of volunteers ready to, well, motivated and ready to fight. The Ukrainians have enough weapons and heavy weapons to arm them. They have to merge them into their military, kick their military back into shape. And so then maybe in a year's time, they'll begin pushing back seriously against the Russian incursions into Ukraine. Guerrilla tactics and not guerrilla tactics, too, because the Ukrainians have missiles, including ballistic missiles. They could actually, if they want to, build some missiles that could hit Moscow, though they don't have nuclear warheads, of course. They have jets. So even if right now Moscow moves forward, then there's a ceasefire, then maybe someday the ceasefire turns into another conflict when Ukraine begins to push Russians out, the Russian military. I would believe that this is, we are in for a long haul, that this is a confrontation that will last for a long time. And, of course, there's the West, which even Russian friends in the West will have to most likely bow to public opinion, which or to Congress, in America, to Congress, which will begin imposing different kinds of sanctions. And some of these sanctions can be very punishing for Russia, especially financial ones, like those they imposed on Iran. It's not so much stopping Russian oil exports or gas exports, but to put restraints on how Russia could move money through electronic accounts. So in Iran, where you can't use any kind of credit card, and everyone has to carry with him a bag of money, either local currency or greenbacks, but it's paper money. It's sure. A paper kind of financial system, which would cripple, of course, the Russian financial system very seriously. Then there's Turkey, where Erdogan will be under pressure from his the Crimean Tatars would be very unhappy with this situation, and there's a very politically active and influential Crimean Tatar diaspora in Turkey. Turkey could say impose restrictions ecologically based on the movement of Russian oil and tankers through the Bosphorus. They already have several times were talking about that they don't like those tankers moving through their Bosphorus. They don't get any money for that transit. So they could very seriously undermine the transit of Russian crude from Novorossiysk through the Bosphorus, where about 30% of Russian oil exports go. So there are many kind of ways in which Western countries, Turkey, could hurt Russia. Of course, Russia will try to hurt in exchange. I believe that we're already in this vicious circle of each side acting and then reacting and then again reacting to what the other is doing. And this does not spell any good in the future. This is going to be rather long, rather dirty, most likely bloody, and very punishing for Russia, for Ukraine, for everyone, more or less.
But when you talk about the Tatars in Crimea, I think they're about a third of the population. They're Muslim, and they've had terrible experiences under Stalin and under the Soviet Union. Would they be a potential guerrilla army in terms of a Russian occupation?
Most likely, yes. Yes, most likely, yes. And there's a wedge that some of them are Salafi jihadists. Well, maybe there are. Mm-hmm. So there could be terrorist attacks, guerrilla warfare, regular warfare, jet fighter bombing raids on both sides, ballistic missiles being lobbed by both sides, Russian and Ukraine. It could be a kind of, Ukrainians, there are 45 million of them. Even if, say, 5 million would fall into Russian lap, or maybe, I don't know, 7 million, but the rest would not. Right. And they will resist, if not all of them, will a sizable number. So this is not 1 million Chechens.
So you think that...
Ukrainians are known to be very tenacious people. If someone gets under their skin.
So just in closing, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, you're telling us that you think Vladimir Putin has really opened up a can of worms, as they say.
Well, yeah, that's very possible. This was a very rash move. He has been very cautious during his long rule in Russia, and that helped him survive. Now he is out on his limb. Maybe he believes that it's his historic destiny to rebuild the empire, the Soviet empire, and that a Western conspiracy has stolen that victory from him by taking Ukraine away and organizing a revolution in Kiev. But he is acting rather irrationally and very rash. It could lead Russia into a lot of woe, and of course not only Russia, a lot of its neighbors.
Well, Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, who is a Moscow-based defense analyst, columnist, and journalist. He previously served as senior research officer in the Soviet Academy of Sciences and published a regular column on defense in the English-language local daily, the Moscow Times. And after more than 6 years as an independent defense analyst, Felgenhauer has joined the staff of Novaya Gazeta. He is a regular commentator on Russia and appears in many other local and international publications. And he joined us from Moscow. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into what options Obama has and what leverage the U.S. and the West has over Putin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He is now a Professor of International Affairs in Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Thanks, Ian. Good to be back with you.
And I must say, our previous guest from Moscow gave an extremely chilling account of how things could go so wrong and that this could be a long war. He talked about how this is Putin, this is not the Russian military, that they could get bogged down in the spring thaw in the east, and at some point or other, there will be a clash with Ukrainian soldiers, and even if they get defeated in the short term, the Ukrainians could come back, and particularly in the summer, when there's more than just the roads that are navigable. In general, from a defense analyst's point of view, you wonder whether Putin can calibrate this reckless move on his part.
I think a lot depends upon what transpires in the next days and weeks. So far, Putin's appetite seems to be restricted to the Crimean Peninsula, where Russian forces enjoy a position of superiority, vast superiority, where you have a major naval base with about 15,000 troops on it, where you have a newly installed provincial governor who is essentially doing what he's told from Moscow. And it's hard for me to see how Russia's grasp on the peninsula is reversed, except if somehow you got an insurgency, a grassroots insurgency that sort of tried to push the Russians out. Eastern Ukraine is a very, very different kettle of fish. We don't yet know whether the Russians are going to try to muck around there, to stir up trouble, to send in troops, to provoke clashes between ethnic Russians and ethnic Ukrainians. If Russia goes there, then I would say that then I think we're really looking at something that could get very dangerous very quickly and could bite boot Putin back. I mean, I agree with, I caught the tail end of your last conversation. I agree with the previous speaker that Putin is acting rashly, but I do think that what's happened here is that he has been dealt a terrible blow. I would say this is the worst blow to Russia since the end of the Cold War. It was a diplomatic failure because the Russians bet on Yanukovych, and Yanukovych was thrown out of his own country as a criminal. And it's a strategic blow because Russia lost Ukraine, a country that has been attached to Russia at the hip. Putin wanted Ukraine to be the junior partner in the Eurasian Union. And what happened on the streets of Kiev is, as Ukrainians stood up and said, hell no, we've had enough of that. We want to enter Europe. And in that sense, it was a real kick in the shins to Putin. And I think he is wounded. He's angry. And he's acting out. And that's what the Crimean grab is all about.
But Charles Kupchin, what do you think went on then in that 90-minute phone conversation between Putin and Obama?
I'm guessing that it was one of the iciest conversations that takes place in diplomacy. And that's because we know that Obama and Putin don't have a terribly good relationship. The relationship basically came to a crashing halt with the Snowden affair. You'll recall that over the last 5 years or so, Obama implemented what was called the reset with Russia, trying to advance rapprochement. And it worked pretty well when Medvedev was in the Kremlin. And now that Putin is back, it's really come to a screeching halt. And then Obama said over the Snowden affair, when the Russians offered him asylum, listen, it's hard for me to do business with this country. And now that you have what I think by all accounts is a bald act of aggression, the relationship, I think, is very tough. And my guess is that Putin and that Obama were trying to find some way of avoiding an escalation. But at this point in time, it seems to me the U.S. position and the Russian position are miles apart and in direct contradiction to each other.
Again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchin, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. So it is my understanding that the relationship is terrible between Putin and Obama, and that Putin has contempt for Obama and thinks he's kind of weak. And I think it's pretty clear that the U.S. Got had over Syria. What do you think is happening with Obama, though? Has he reached a point where he feels he's got to do something because he's been had and pushed around by this guy?
Well, I wouldn't quite put it in those terms. I don't think Obama has been had. I think he was in a very difficult position in Syria where he wanted to use military force and the American people in Congress weren't ready to back him. And to some extent, the Russians took advantage of that and offered Obama a way out of that impasse. But whether or not Obama has been weak, I think this is a crisis that's really not provoked by American weakness, because the Russians more or less have a hold sway in this part of Europe. Nobody could have prevented them from going in the Crimea if they wanted to. But I do think that we are at a point where Obama has to respond and has to respond with some pretty forceful actions. And that's partly because Obama needs to dig in and demonstrate to some of his critics that he has mettle, but also because this is a pretty flagrant violation of international norms. I think it goes well beyond what happened in Georgia in 2008 when the Russians sent troops into Abkhazia and South Ossetia, two breakaway regions. It is a violation of UN norms against open attacks and violations of sovereignty. And so I expect to see over the next few days, in coordination with European allies, possibly with a wider range of countries, steps ranging from canceling the G20 summit, perhaps withdrawing ambassadors, maybe suspending Russia's participation in the G8, economic sanctions, visa bans. And it's also conceivable to me that there could be military overtones to the U.S. response. And by that, I mean an effort by NATO to bolster defenses along the eastern frontier, perhaps the deployment of troops in Poland, the Baltic countries, and other new members of NATO that feel particularly uneasy with what's happened. If we head down that road, I don't think that one could say we're back in the Cold War, but we're certainly headed toward a relationship with Russia that that is much more troubled than it's been since the early 90s when the Soviet Union fell apart.
But Charles Kupchan, wouldn't those kind of dynamics of cutting diplomatic and economic ties and returning to a kind of Cold War-like standoff, wouldn't that play further into Putin's hands? I mean, he's basically blaming all of this on the CIA and the West of meddling in his backyard. It would seem that if the West behaves in that kind of predictable way, which you know, basically cuts ties and cuts what, I mean, there's not much of a liberal class left in Russia, clearly, but it seems to be, there's an element of shooting ourselves in the foot too, isn't there, in isolating Russia even further?
Yes, there's no question about that. I mean, if you look at the international agenda right now, the top items on it need cooperation with Russia, right? Syria, Russia is a key player. Iran, if we're going to neutralize Iran's nuclear program, Russia figures prominently. Afghanistan, getting out, trying to deal with a post-withdrawal country. Afghanistan is a place where the Russians have a lot of influence. Energy, about a quarter of European gas comes from Russia. In fact, it flows through Ukraine. The pipelines go from Russia into Ukraine and into the European Union. So there is a huge stake that rides on this. That having been said, you know, what do we do? Do we say Russia is so important that we should just turn a blind eye? I'm afraid we can't do that. But you're right to say that we have to be careful. We need to take steps that say that this kind of intervention in the 21st century is unacceptable, not to mention the 20th century, and find ways of pushing back without doing things that could risk escalation in a way that damages the United States and its Western partners.
So if you were to compare this to, say, Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, which was a violation of international law, as is you know, the well, they haven't invaded the Ukraine proper; they've taken annexed Crimea, but assuming that things, as Dr. Pavel Feldmanow suggested, they're likely to get a lot worse, and the Russian Parliament has given Putin a blank check to move in anywhere on Ukrainian territory.
That's correct.
Would you then, obviously, we George the Bush number one, 41, yeah. He did organize and took his time about it and organized a huge military force from around the world. Obviously, that's not out of the question. But could Obama marshal a diplomatic army, if you will?
Yes. And I think that a lot of that is probably going on as we speak. There will be no military response to this. Somehow, you know, inserting NATO troops or getting on the ground with Ukrainian forces, I just think all of that is simply out of the question. partly because it's not feasible and partly because it's not worth it. The United States has a dog in this fight, but it's not a dog that warrants American military intervention. But I do think that what we will see is U.S., European Union, democratic allies around the world. I wouldn't be surprised if other countries that are often on Russia's side speak up in opposition to what's happened here. And so coming back to Putin's motives, I think this is going to leave Russia in a weaker position globally, because Putin has made a business of being a leader who stands up to Washington, who leads those disgruntled with Western hegemony. And I'm afraid that he's gone a bit too far here and demonstrated that he really is more interested in power grabs, in a kind of diplomacy that looks like it is not one with any kind of benign intent, but one that throws the world back decades, if not centuries.
And, of course, his whole foreign policy is predicated upon non-interference in others' affairs. So I thank you for joining us, Charles Kupchan.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service and is a Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with a Ukrainian specialist on nationalism, revolutions, and empire, looking into what Kiev can do to reach out to the Russian-speaking East. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Alexander Motl, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory. He's the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Developments of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Motl.
Thanks for having me.
And it's pretty shocking for the new leader of Ukraine, not that he doesn't have his hands full now with a Russian military occupation of Crimea and a threatened occupation of the eastern part of Ukraine, but he's just discovered that the treasury is bare and that they have $37 billion in loans have disappeared from Ukraine's treasury, and that up to $70 billion has been sent out of the country during Yanukovych's presidency. So obviously, on top of the military challenges, he's got economic challenges. But let's start with the military challenges. What's your understanding where we stand now with a call for mobilizing the Ukrainian military?
Well, the military, as you say, has been mobilized. They've also started calling in adult males to sign up. There seems to be an adequate response to that. There have been all sorts of statements by leading intellectuals, ordinary people, and others, both Russian speakers and Ukrainian speakers, that they will pick up arms and fight for the country. One of the most poignant ones was a statement by Ukraine's first president, Leonid Kravchuk, who said that even though he's 80 years old, he'll pick up a gun and fight. So there has been this mobilization, and it's very, you know, that's obviously of some importance. One hopes that it never comes to the point of needing to be used, that is to say, the army. But it's certainly a statement on the part of the government that they will at least try to retain their integrity and sovereignty. I think in some ways more important as a signal to Putin vis-a-vis his potential intentions in other parts of Ukraine and especially in the east are three things. One is just today, Ukraine's richest man, the oligarch Renat Akhmetov, who happens to be based in Donetsk, which is also, and he was also Yanukovych's primary financial supporter, issued a statement in support of Ukraine's integrity and sovereignty and peace and all those sorts of things. He also called upon Russian businessmen to try to act in some kind of peaceful manner. That is very important because that makes him the fifth such oligarch, four of whom are Russian speakers, and not even ethnic Ukrainians necessarily, who've come out in support of Ukrainian integrity in the last few days. And inasmuch as money does decide many things, not just in Ukraine, this is significant. The other significant development is that in two of the key oblasts, the provinces in eastern Ukraine, Dnipropetrovsk and Donetsk, two of the key oligarchs from that region, Mr. Taruta in Donetsk and Mr. Kolomoisky in Dnipropetrovsk, have agreed to be governors. That, I think, again, is a very significant step and should be stabilizing in as much as they've got the financial clout and now they'll presumably have some political clout. And last but not least, today, there have been mass demonstrations in a whole series of East Ukrainian cities, even in some of the least likely places like Odessa, Mykolaiv, and others, where anywhere from 5 to 10 to 15,000 people have been demonstrating against war, against Putin's intervention, and in support of sovereignty and integrity. All of these, I think, are potentially stabilizing factors, and they should certainly serve as signals to Vladimir Putin that he may have to think not just twice, but perhaps even three or four times before he embarks on another adventure in eastern Ukraine.
But it seems as though Putin, almost what's happened in the build-up to this crisis is in Russia, in terms of the way the media in Russia has been used to whip up this war fever. It's almost like a psyop, what Putin has done. And I thought, you know, last week that this was heading this way because I didn't see how Putin could walk back from calling all these people in Kiev terrorists, etc., and fascists.
Right.
And it's true that, you know, that they are unelected. You have had a revolution there. And it would seem to me that this is a critical time for the people in Kiev to reach out and reassure the Russian-speaking people in the east. And I'm not sure that they've done that. In fact, there have been talk about Ukrainian being the official language and this kind of stuff. So how much of hotheads in Kiev stirring up or giving Putin the kind of excuses, not that he really needs them, but the ones that he's using?
Right.
You know.
Well, The only step that they've taken, which was considered to be controversial, this was done about a week ago, is the parliament rescinded a law passed by the Yanukovych regime about 2 years ago. It was called the Law on Minority Languages and Regional Languages. And at the time that the law was passed, it was roundly criticized by virtually the entire Ukrainian intelligentsia, intellectuals, artists, and so on, as being discriminatory, but against Ukrainian. And that was ultimately its intent. I mean, it partly gave certain advantages to Russian. I don't think anybody would have objected to that. But it actually demoted the status of Ukrainian within the country. So they dismissed the law, they rescinded the law, and there was, of course, concern in the east. As soon as that happened, however, this is the important thing, a number of actions followed. first of all, the day after, 2 days after, roughly, a group of intellectuals in Lviv, the western Ukrainian city, stated that for an entire day they would only speak Russian in solidarity with their brethren in the east. That was then picked up by intellectuals in Odessa, Luhansk, and Donetsk, who said that in turn they would only speak Ukrainian for that day. Well, that didn't seem to assuage the tempers of the hotheads in the eastern Oblast. And in response to that, 3 days ago, roughly, 3 days, I believe, the acting president said he vetoed that particular rescindment of that particular bill. So now part of the Yatsenyuk government's task is to write a new law on languages, which would presumably assuage both East, West Ukrainian speakers as well as Russian speakers. In addition to that, the acting president issued a statement yesterday that he intends to expand the rights of the provinces and regions, and that's one of the main demands made by the Easterners. My sense personally is that if this were simply a question of Kiev versus the eastern or southern, or for that matter, western provinces, then it's pretty much the kind of tussle that you encounter in most complex, multicultural, multinational states. And there's usually a formula that you can work out. There's usually a deal that you can work out. You give them a little bit of this or a little bit of that. You restructure certain rules, more autonomy, less, you know, more money, more autonomy, more rights, more language, more culture, something along those lines. The problem for Ukraine is that regardless of what people in Kiev do, whether they're hotheads or not, Putin and his media have their own particular agenda. And they impose their own particular views on whatever happens to be taking place. They propagate that in the media. They find supporters of those views in Ukraine's eastern oblasts, and the result is, well, what we have. So in a way, ultimately, it really all depends on Putin. If he wants a peaceful resolution, I think it's there. It's easy to come up with something like that. If he doesn't want a peaceful resolution, I'm not exactly sure that there's anything Kiev can do to satisfy him. Well, short of, I guess, you know, just giving up the ghost and surrendering.
Right, total capitulation.
Right.
Again, I'm speaking with Alexander Model, who's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory, and is the author of Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919-1929. So, obviously, Putin's basic point of having to protect Russian-speaking and ethnic Russians in Crimea and in the east of... because he did basically... he used the word Ukraine. He didn't specifically say he was just going to protect people in Crimea, but in Ukraine in general. So he has pretty much, it's an open book on what he might do next. But
I think you're absolutely right. That's the dangerous part. I mean, the takeover of Crimea is worrisome. It's dangerous. It's essentially an act of imperialism. But for better or for worse, it's localized. It's focused on the Crimea. The problem is that yesterday he made an appeal to the Council of the Federation of the State Council of Russia, in which he requested that they give him the right to defend Russian citizens and co-brethren, that's the terminology, quote, on the territory of Ukraine, and then, quote, until conditions in the country normalize. Now, territory of Ukraine means anywhere, as you just said, and until conditions in the country normalize means that Putin decides when conditions in the country normalize, which means, in other words, anywhere and for an indefinite period of time.
Well, it also means that he could
he could make this argument that we need to reconstitute the Soviet Union, because if he is free to act to protect Russian minorities, even though they're not necessarily being harassed or repressed in any way, that would he can move into Estonia under that excuse, Latvia, all over the place. There's Russian minorities. So that's the part of it that I find extraordinary. But again, you know, this is somebody whose political modus operandi is to essentially stir up Russian nationalism and appeal to sometimes to the darkest side. I imagine this is probably very popular in Russia.
Oh yes. I mean, you know, there is this perception on the part of many Russians that the Russians in places like Estonia, Latvia, Belarus, Ukraine, Kazakhstan are experiencing enormous oppression and things like that. And of course, by and large, that's just not the case. I mean, if they're living in countries with poor economies like Ukraine, then they're likely to be as bad off as anybody else. But there's nothing specifically Russian about the poverty that they might have to endure. Alternatively, if they're living in countries like Estonia and Latvia, then of course they're very well off because they've got access to the European Union and all the goodies that that brings. None of that seems to matter to policymakers in Moscow, like Putin, or for that matter his colleagues in the State Duma, where they have these, frankly, you know, perverted notions of what's actually going on to their brethren, as they call them, in these particular regions. You know, at the risk of being very provocative, but I do think one of the parallels that one has to keep in mind is the similarity between Putin and his rise to power and his appeals to nationalism and these kinds of minority issues in neighboring states, and those exercised by a certain German 70, 80 years ago. We find very, there are very striking and, of course, very worrisome parallels. I mean, looking for Sudetenlands where, you know, Russians are presumably being oppressed.
Well, certainly that is a similar MO to Hitler's, the idea that you have to rescue your brethren, and that's just a convenient excuse for a territorial grab. But what's your sense then? We started out talking about the economic challenges that Yatsenyuk, the new president, has. That's pretty bad in itself, right? $70 billion has gone out of the country during Yanukovych's presidency. So the treasury's bare. You've got the Russians essentially taken over Crimea, now threatening over to take over the East. What could be? I mean, there's not much that the U.S. or Europe can do. Is it possible? And if I called you next week, that your former country would be a third of, or two thirds of what it used to be, or even half, about a half, right?
Well, my sense is that. Well, let me answer 2 points. I mean, one regarding the state of the economy. Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a mess. It's a catastrophe, and it's likely to remain a mess, if not a catastrophe, for a certain period of time. On the other hand, I do suspect that the West, especially now in light of the incursion in Crimea, will be rather more inclined to be supportive of Ukraine economically and financially. It's no longer just a question of propping up a potentially democratic or a genuinely democratic government. Now it's a question of actually stopping an aggression. So that will work to Ukraine's benefit. By the same token, as you know, Liechtenstein, Switzerland, and Austria just declared last week that they would be freezing the accounts of something like 18 or 20 top Ukrainian officials from the Yanukovych government. So there's at least the potential for some kind of restitution of the money that they stole. And then last but not least, what works in at least to some degree to the benefit of the Yatsenyuk government, if and when this crisis calms down, is the fact that there has been this significant rallying around the flag both by Ukrainian speakers and by Russian speakers. I'd alluded to that before. And I think that that will make it significantly easier for him to introduce the kinds of radical, painful measures that are unavoidable. I mean, people will appreciate that something has to be done or else. As to your other question, well, will Ukraine be at what it is at present? Obviously, it all depends on, you know, again, as I don't want to weasel out of it, but clearly it depends much on what Putin will or will not do. My sense is that the furthest he'll go in terms of further annexations is perhaps something like Luhansk, which has a large Russian population, which has always been very pro-Soviet, pro-Russian. That might be relatively easy to pull off. Although there, too, according to a public opinion survey that was just published today, only 32% of the total population supports annexation to Russia, which of course means that 68% are opposed to it. Nevertheless, that might be doable. My guess is that places like Kharkiv, Donetsk, Zaporozhye are no longer, will not be as easy to swallow as Crimea was. And remember, Crimea already had a large contingent of Russian forces. You could invade simply by telling them to leave their barracks. The eastern oblasts are a little more complicated. One actually has to cross an international border or alternatively drop in parachutes. There is very likely to be resistance by at least some elements of the army, at least some elements of the internal forces, at least some elements of the population. So it wouldn't be a cakewalk. Putin would have to be very, very foolhardy at this point in time to undertake that kind of step. That said, let me temper what I've just said by underlying that a week ago, I would have said, and I did say, that Putin would have had to be very foolhardy to attack Crimea. And he did. So, in a sense, all bets are off, because it's not clear that he's motivated by any kind of strategic geopolitical calculus of costs and benefits, but instead seems primarily to be motivated by his own need for legitimacy, his own need for chest beating and for demonstrating to the street in Russia that he's still a strong man. And if that's the case, if he's this kind of irrational individual, then we just don't know.
Well, Alexander Bertel, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexander Myrtle. He's a professor of political science at Rutgers University, as well as a writer and painter. He previously served as associate director of the Harriman Institute at Columbia University and is a specialist on Ukraine, Russia, and the USSR, and on nationalism, revolutions, empires, and theory, and is the author of a number of books, including Dilemmas of Independence, Ukraine After Totalitarianism, and The Turn to the Right, The Ideological Origins and Development of Ukrainian Nationalism, 1919 to 1929. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.